Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Thanks for coming, everyone, to our SSSN seminar. So without further ado, I will introduce our speaker, who is Rodney Wallace, Dr. Rodney Wallace, who did his PhD, completed his PhD here at UNSW in 2016, and it was on the representations of the Arab-Israeli conflict in Hollywood cinema. So please make him feel welcome.
Well, my PhD supervisor's here, so I'm suddenly very nervous. I'm used to speaking to students. Okay, so let me preface this by saying this is just kind of an idea I've had bouncing around for a while. It's not probably as well thought out as some of the other presentations you've seen. It's very much in its embryonic stage. Who here has seen Shane? Most of you? Okay. Well, hopefully those of you who haven't will want to see it after this. So following the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in December 2012 that claimed the lives of 28 people, including 20 young children, the CEO of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre, famously declared, "The only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun." And in the years since Sandy Hook, the NRA and its Republican clients have reliably spewed forth similar rhetoric as a way of combating calls for increased gun control, usually in the wake of another mass shooting. For instance, after the recent massacre at Marjory Stoneman High School in Parkland, Florida, where Nicholas Cruz armed himself with an AR-15 rifle and shot dead 17 students and teachers, Donald Trump asserted with trademark eloquence, "If you had a teacher who was adept at firearms, it could very well end the attack very quickly." Similarly, Vice President Mike Pence, at an NRA rally soon after the Parkland School massacre, blamed the media for distorting the gun debate by focusing too much on a few villains rather than the many heroes who use their guns to prevent violence. "Start telling the whole story to the American people about firearms in this country," Pence said, to sustained applause. "We should be a nation that recognizes the people who save lives much more than the people who take them." He reassured NRA members that they were one of the most potent forces for good in the United States of America. Now, while this can rightly be seen as a cynical appeal to the anxieties of a terrified populace, terrified, it must be said, of both violent criminals and government regulation of firearms in the wake of increased calls for gun control, it nonetheless speaks to the peculiar resonance of the idea of an armed savior in American culture. In this paper, I'll explore the ways in which Hollywood has contributed to this ideal through a discussion of the classic, self-consciously mythic Western Shane, directed by George Stevens, released in 1953. Through my examination of Shane, I will demonstrate how Westerns throughout this period bound together the image of the gun with notions of heroism, individualism, masculinity, justice, and democratic process, in turn making significant contributions to the promotion and circulation of gun culture throughout the United States. So I just have to preface what I'm going to say with a bit of a description of the Western and its kind of centrality to American identity. So through its retelling of stories that center on one of the defining periods of the United States' development into nationhood, the Western has played a central role in the construction and projection of an idealized notion of American identity. With the end of World War II and the subsequent ascension of the United States to a position of unrivaled preeminence in the world, the Western emerged as Hollywood's dominant mode of national myth-making. Between the years 1947 and 1950, Westerns constituted roughly 30% of Hollywood's total output. For many scholars, the fact that the emergence of the Western coincided with America's rise to global preeminence was no mere coincidence. With the destruction of Europe and the American-led defeat of Japan, the United States now assumed the role of a global superpower, which enabled American history to once again be read as a kind of success story. Shane is perhaps the ultimate example of the classic 50s Western. Matthew Carter, in his recent book, The Myth of the Western, accurately describes the film As an archetypal Western, the classic Western, in fact, an overtly mythic distillation of the historical migration of the Anglo-American pioneers in the Wyoming Basin. The film tells the story of a mysterious figure by the name of Shane, who rides into a frontier community populated by honest, hardworking pioneer folk and single-handedly rescues them from a ruthlessly terroristic cattle baron before riding off into the sunset with what are presumed to be fatal wounds sustained in battle with the baron's henchmen. It's crucial here to note that I posit that the film's classic status is not based merely on its formal elements such as the writing, acting, cinematography, but also the manner in which it articulates a myriad of conflicts and themes that are central to the myth of the frontier. It's an overt celebration of white settlement and its supposed centrality to the subsequent development of America as a nation. For instance, there's a scene in which the townsfolk celebrate Independence Day. There is the typical erasure of Black Americans from the historical narrative, despite some references to the Civil War. There's also no reference to the native inhabitants of the land, apart from one notable scene in which they are invoked as an obstacle to progress in earlier times before they were heroically and justifiably extinguished by white settlers. There's also a class conflict in the form of small landowners versus big business. There is the establishment of law and order on the frontier. There are scenes in which the homesteaders vote on a path of action, which serves to celebrate the supposed sanctity of democratic process. There were scenes that explore the aftermath of the Civil War and its persisting enmities, most notably through a homesteader referred to as Stonewall, who was a famous Civil War general, I believe, who is shot dead after being baited by the evil gunslinger Wilson, who refers to the Confederate leaders as trash. Sorry, just had a mental blank there. Also, the film serves to lionize individualism and hypermasculinity through the title character, who is a classic archetypal lone hero. So what is significant is that this compression of mythological elements occurs in conjunction with what I consider to be the film's overt sanctification of gun culture, which in turn results in the film both reflecting and perpetuating America's historical obsession with the armed savior. So American cultural historian Richard Slotkin describes the film's message as a good man with a gun is in every sense the best of men, an armed redeemer who is the sole vindicator of the liberties of the people, the indispensable man in the quest for progress. Slotkin positions the film, along with a host of other gunfighter westerns from the period, as an expression of American anxiety as a result of its newfound post-war supremacy. Without wanting to contest that reading, what I would like to focus on is how the film's message, that a good man with a gun is in every sense the best of men, eerily preempts the modern-day rhetoric of the NRA, wherein, to recall Wayne LaPierre following the Sandy Hook massacre, the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. So at this point, I want to show a clip where Shane, this is at the beginning of the film, Shane is demonstrating to young Joey how to use a gun.
I know where is it to, Shane.
Well, I guess I don't see as many advantages.
Shane?
Mm-hmm. A gun is as good or as bad as the man using it.
So, from an ideological standpoint, I think this scene is notable for two reasons. First, it reinforces how learning how to use a gun is framed as an important rite of passage for young American boys. And it's very notable that it is Shane rather than the boy's ineffectual father who is delivering this lesson. And secondly, the point that Shane made at the end there, where he says, "Gun is just a tool. What makes it good or bad is the man that is using it." And to kind of link this up with NRA rhetoric, because bad men always exist, because by their very nature, they will have weapons and be prepared to use them, not only is there necessity, but there's nobility in good men being adept in the arts of violence. So this point is reinforced quite unequivocally, in my opinion, in the climactic shootout. Okay. Exactly. So Shane's nobility is affirmed in this scene, not merely through his single-handed elimination of the bad guys, but through the very deliberate staging of the shootout. So I'm actually going to steal from Matthew Carter, who has a great quote about this, how this sequence imparts the inherent righteousness of Shane's violence. He says, through a deliberate editing contrivance, Wilson is seen to draw first, and this has the effect of positioning him as the aggressor, whereas Shane, by drawing second, only faster, occupies the moral high ground. Hence, Shane speaks the language of the genre. And Shane's slaying of Wilson and the Rikers equates the hero's violence not with an act of aggression, but with an unavoidable and noble defense of the values of American civilization. And what is notable, in my opinion, is that this sequence is basically just a punctuation mark, as the entire film engages in unequivocal fetishization of the gunslinger. Most notably, there's a pronounced juxtaposition between the masculinity and heroism of Shane and the inherent weakness and vulnerability of those less proficient in the art of gun violence. I don't know if I'll actually show this clip because this is taking a bit longer than I thought. But early in the film, there is a scene where Shane and Starrett, who is Joey's father, they remove a tree stump. And basically, Shane gets up to have breakfast with the family, sees the stump outside, and then just goes out without even asking if he should help remove it and just starts chopping at it. And Starrett remarks how he's been working on it for 2 years, but he's able to remove it the first day Shane helps him. And at the end of the scene, Shane is shirtless and all, you know, muscly and sweaty and everything. And Starrett is still wearing essentially his underwear. And he does not look anywhere near as rugged and handsome and masculine as Alan Ladd does, as Shane. So from this point on in the film, the young boy Joey is constantly gushing over Shane, asking his father questions like, do you think you could beat Shane in a fight? Are you faster on the draw than Shane? And hopefully you recall the scene I showed earlier where Shane plays the role of the surrogate father teaching the boy how to shoot. So while the father's still alive, Shane is consistently positioned as the ideal father figure for the young boy. Also, soon after the scene where they remove the tree stump, there's a sequence in a local tavern where Shane essentially single-handedly stands up to the bad guys, fighting them all on his own, while the rest of the ranchers stand and watch until Starrett eventually joins in. And also, Shane's superior manhood is encapsulated just prior to that final shootout, where Starrett tells his wife that he's riding off to face Riker. He takes his gun with him. And Shane comes out of nowhere and beats him up to prevent him from riding off. And he knocks him unconscious with his pistol. It's also significant to note that prior to this scene, Starrett tells his wife that should something happen to him, he gives his consent for her to be with Shane. And in his own words, Shane could take care of her and Joey better than I could myself. And it's worth noting that the mutual attraction between Shane and Starrett's wife, Marion, is frequently hinted at throughout the film and is fairly overt. So just as the film positions the gunfighter Shane as the idealized replacement for Starrett as a father, he's also the idealized replacement for him as a husband. And just in case the audience doesn't pick up on this throughout the film, in the very final scene that comes after the shootout, and I will show this because it's important. This is how the film ends.
Joey, what are you doing?
I'm sorry, shame?
You don't have to be.
So you probably don't need this pointed out to you, but I think it's extraordinary that in this film, you've just had a man kill a bunch of people and a little boy yells out, "Mother wants you, I know she does." Given that his father is still very much alive, I read that as, again, a punctuation mark on the film's unequivocal celebration of the armed savior. And it's reflective of his central role in American life. So that's it. As I said, embryonic, but hopefully you enjoyed it.
All right, so I will let Ben begin the Q&A session.
I'm not looking forward to this because you said to me that you disagree with my reading of the film. So,
Look, I mean, that's kind of what this right. session's all about, right? Like, it's, I mean, I guess before I kind of test strips from your reading then, I mean, maybe would it be useful for you to kind of tell us as a group what you're intending with this piece? I mean, you were suggesting to me you think that this might be a small part of a kind of book project. I mean, can you position what you're anticipating to do with this material?
I want to make it clear that I'm not ascribing, you know, a huge amount of influence and power to this one text. I see Shane as kind of representative of kind of frontier mythology that came before the film, and also as being very influential on a lot of the films that followed, and not just other Westerns, but also, I mentioned Taxi Driver. There's a host of film noirs and 80s action films and science fiction films that all kind of borrow tropes from the Western. So I just kind of see Shane as kind of emblematic of a certain style of filmmaking or even mythology that goes beyond cinema that celebrates, you know, that armed savior ideal in a way that's very unique, I think, to American culture.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I guess kind of one of the kind of starting points for me then would be, why do you think that, just based on your response as well then, like, why do you think Shane is kind of so emblematic of this argument you're trying to make? Is it kind of doing something different to other Westerns of the same time or prior to it?
I think it really crystallizes all the kind of disparate elements of the Western really clearly. Like, you know, okay. I mentioned in the paper how it's not just about this lone gunfighter. It kind of is a meditation on democratic process and on the kind of recovery after the Civil War for the United States, the kind of erasure of certain ethnicities from the historical narrative. Like, it's just a very emblematic Western, I think. Like, if someone said to me, what 50s Western should I see if I want to get into Westerns or understand what the genre is about, Shane is the one I would point to.
Okay.
And it's also an adaptation of kind of earlier canonic Westerns as well, like The Virginian and things like that.
Mm. I guess, you know, kind of what I was talking to you kind of before you started is when I think about Shane, I think about it as kind of almost concurrent or almost the kind of arbiter of the kind of anti-Western in a sense. I mean, you're kind of suggesting that there's a heroicization of the Shane figure as kind of this kind of ultimate gunslinger. And I think, you know, in a sense, I think this film for me ushers in more of that kind of anti-Western tradition. It's kind of, I don't think it's as clear cut as you're making it in the kind of lionization of the hero figure in you know, as emblematized in Shane. I mean, clearly, you know, as was shown in those clips that you were showing, a lot of this is coming from the perspective of the child, from Joey, and obviously he kind of adores the Shane figure. I wonder if the film more broadly adores him in that kind of sense.
Well, I would argue it does. And the kind of
heroicization of Shane that you're talking about, and the point you're making earlier, which was how it's kind of the beginning of the anti-Western. I would say that it's really just, again, to use that word, emblematic of Westerns of that period, which is after the World War II and things like that, and America starts having to, not so much having to, but they insert itself in conflicts around the world, and they're kind of juggling this notion of being liberators and this force for good in the world, but also reconciling that with, you know, the horrible violence that they have to perpetrate in order to do that. And you've got films like a film called The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck that has a similar kind of tension in it. High Noon is another film that also kind of juggles those ideals. Like, I think it's, I'm kind of stealing from Richard Slotkin here, but I think that's kind of what 50s Westerns were doing.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a host of films that are nowhere near as good or as well known as Shane that essentially reproduce the narrative of that film. Like,
okay.
You know, it was what Westerns were to a large degree in that period, culminating, I would say, in The Magnificent Seven at the end of the decade, which is kind of Shane on steroids because there's seven of them.
That's so quotable. I'm going to take that.
Feel free to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess kind of, you know, to pull a little bit more on this kind of thread, I mean, Shane himself as a character, you were talking about him as a kind of hyper-masculine figure. And, you know, I've just got to say, like, why did you not show us Alan Ladd without a shirt? But you know, putting aside my own...
Well, it was
But
I recommend everyone does have a look at that image, but... it was more a time constraint. I thought sure. I got a vibe that maybe some of the clips were going too long.
Not at all. Maybe that was a mistake. Yeah. Alan Ladd without a shirt. Highly recommended. Two thumbs up for those that are listening on the podcast.
Very sweaty.
Yeah, very glistening. Sweaty. Glistening. Absolutely. But anyway, I guess kind of the point I'm kind of trying to tease out here is that Shane himself as a character, you've talked about him as a kind of hyper-masculine figure throughout this paper. But there's also, you also kind of mentioned the tension in your last kind of response to my response here. Shane as a character is kind of feminized in the film as well. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, as far as how he's first presented to us, how he's dressed, you know, the tassels on his costume, for example. I mean, the fact that he doesn't drink hard liquor when he enters the bar and that he's made a mockery of because of that. There's a kind of sense in which he's almost kind of stripped of power and he's kind of feminized at the same time as he's kind of overtly masculinized in a different space, in a kind of home space, if you like. I don't necessarily know if I have a question here, but I guess I'm kind of trying to tease out this kind of tension that I see, and I don't necessarily see it as kind of straightforward as you seem to present him as this hyper-masculine figure. I'm like, well... Maybe.
Well, I think the hyper-masculinity is the result of an evolution of the character. But I would argue that the character's teetotalism, is that a word? I think it's more that he is introduced in the film as a kind of almost religious figure, like a savior.
Sure.
Rather than so much he's feminized. Because the buckskins and everything, that goes back to Davy Crockett and, you know, these really central figures in terms of American mythology. Maybe with our present-day context, it looks kind of odd and maybe feminized, but I think it is more that he is this kind of noble figure that is above humanity.
Right.
That's how I would read it, and that's why he rides off into the sunset to go and rescue another town. That's how figure. That's what I expect happens after the film,
right?
Essentially, like, you don't see the blood, you know.
Yeah, right. It's almost like we planned this or something, because that leads directly into my next question, and I'll stop speaking any second now if anyone wants to jump in. But I guess one of the other kind of threads that I was pulling on when I was reading your paper and listening to you give it then is, you know, I kept coming back to this fact that you pointed out. You know, Shane kind of belts the father over the head and so he's not in danger and Shane goes and does all the killing and blah, blah, blah.
Martyrs himself.
Yeah, he literally does martyr himself. And I wonder if there's not something that you can pull on here to more kind of directly align this kind of sense of martyrdom and kind of American mythology. I mean, is there something there that we can tap into to kind of more kind of heavily theorize this a little bit?
There probably is. Right. I just haven't thought of it yet.
Sure.
That's something I'm going to have to take note of as I do more research.
Sure.
Does anyone else have a response to that question?
Does anyone have any questions at all?
I have a question. I think it's building from the point that Ben is working towards a bit. Thank you, first of all, for your presentation. I think you've done a really nice job of teasing out this sort of narrative progression in American culture between, say, Davy Crockett figures and then a figure like Shane moving towards Wayne LaPierre and Mike Pence. I'm curious, and I'm picking up on the term anti-Western that Ben used, do you think that the connection between this sort of myth of the Western figure that you're talking about and the Western genre itself make those two things inextricable? I.e., is the Western genre sort of inherently one of myth? Or if we look at these terms like anti-Western and thinking of films like Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, for example, can that relationship make for a sort of productive site of critique?
So I would argue this idea of the anti-Western, it's kind of a misnomer in the sense that the Western is always responding to what's going on culturally. So kind of the anti-Western, in my opinion, emerges when the traditional narratives about America start to get turned on their head. I don't know if I would consider The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance as an anti-Western so much. I think it's, maybe we can talk about it a bit more, but I think it's more about the Western and the dime novel culture that preceded the Western and how it was very consciously about creating mythology, and that film is, you know, a demonstration of that. Like where the character, the newspaper editor, I think, says, you know, what's the quote? He says something like, print the legend or something like that.
something like that.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's really that much of an anti-Western, that one, but I guess, again, to go back to my original point, I think we should just read anti-Westerns as Westerns that are responding to the culture themselves, like the Wild Bunch and things like that that are happening when Vietnam is also, you know, opinion about Vietnam is starting to turn, right? And that film's a reflection on that.
The reason I use that term, is exactly what you're talking about, the sort of calling attention to the construction of narrative that I think is maybe more obscured, at least in something like Shane, although I think maybe we're sort of getting towards evidence that it's not quite so clear-cut as sort of hero, villain, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering, again, though, if the genre itself is sort of a genre of mythologization,
That's why I'm interested in it.
Right.
Like, I don't think you can read any Western as being separate from the culture and the moment of its production.
Right.
It's by far the most self-conscious genre and the most fertile source of mythology.
Right.
You would agree?
Yeah.
Right.
I was interested in what you were saying about, you said something about like, the tension of violence in this film. And for me, I had a very different interpretation of violence in this film because for me, it was a very anti-violent film. And particularly that last scene where Shane like has to kind of, he says, you know, like, there's no turning back, you know, there's no turning back up. Like for me, it was like, there's no turning back from violence and there's no turning back.
I've been branded, I think was
the
question.
Yeah, after you've been branded, after you've been, you know, like using the literary thing that like everyone's kind of been against the whole film. So I think I read that and stuff. I think the director said that it was like, he was critiquing the destructiveness of violence and, at one point, he said he used cannons as a way of like sound effects for the guns to just show like how destructive they are. So I guess with your argument by saying, you know, the good man and the bad man with the gun, you know, like there's no, like it reflects NRA and stuff like modern times. how would you balance, or how would you, I guess, like, take into that factor? And also with the blood as well, when he rides off, and I know like there is interpretation that he continues on and does the same thing in another town, but then again, he is shot, you know, like...
And he does slump.
I mean,
he does slump
that
in that final scene.
I think he's going off to die.
Well, that was my take as well. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you can take it the way that you want to, but how would you, I guess, take into factor that tension of that other interpretation that, you know?
Well, even if he does die, he still is a martyr that is totally worshipped by essentially everyone. Like, he's totally elevated. I think anyone who watched that film, especially when it came out and without the cynicism of today, would think Shane is just a wonderful character. So it's like, I know, I feel like the film is kind of paying lip service to how bad violence is, but at the end of the day, they're still glorifying the heroic violence, I would say. And it's like, we see that even today with action films, right? Like, like war movies, like almost every director will tell you that their movie is anti-war, but most of them make war look really cool.
Yeah, I mean, they're replicating the tropes of war. And this is one of the quotes I always come back to by John Carlos Rowe when he talks about kind of anti-war film. He suggests that it doesn't matter how anti-war a film is, the fact that they're reproducing the violence of war automatically is a kind of, you know, go team kind of thing. Like, you know, you will take those war tropes as a person, you know, for what you will.
And I guess it's, in my opinion, it's important to not read a film in a vacuum. Like, you know, the people who were watching this film in the 50s would have been growing up playing cowboys and Indians, and toy guns would have been one of the first things people bought their sons. You know, it's part of an entire culture that is around gun violence. And I think I said this on paper, but I think it's really... what I take from it is that the filmmaker is saying, maybe even at a subconscious level, that bad men will always exist and they will have guns because guns are available. So we need to have good men who know how to use guns as well. And that's kind of what the NRA are saying one way or the other right now as well.
The guy who played Wilson was in the film right before this was a bad guy as well.
He's was in 1,000 West Times.
I know, but Southern Fear is a noir. It's a noir film.
And noir films replicate the same tropes of the Western. Yeah.
Zach, any question?
So I was going to ask you, because to the extent that this now lines up with contemporary rhetoric around gun culture and its lionizing, etc., how are you... because the thing that I find really interesting and difficult about this particular approach is that I agree that I see those kinds of moralizing of violence in this film and its promotion, but at the same time I'm wary because I know that the same argument is used conservatively in a different way with media effects to suggest that, and by the NRA as well, to suggest that the reason people are killing people is because they're playing video games and watching war movies. So how do you put those two things into conversation where there is the kind of moral argument that is promoted or is being prosecuted by a film like this, and then there's also the other kind of argument that imagines that the distance between spectator and film has collapsed so much that you can be inspired by a film like this to go out and shoot people. How do those two sort of different politically motivated arguments play?
One thing that I didn't talk about but is in my notes to further develop in an article is how this film simultaneously appeals to people on both sides of the political spectrum, which I think is what makes it very effective. It appeals to kind of the liberal side that is against corporations and big government kind of trampling on small business owners and things like that. And you've also got a kind of fascistic element to it. So yeah, I have to unpack that a bit more. To go back to your question, though, I mean, I'm not trying to say this film encourages gun violence, but I think why I find this film interesting is because it both reflects attitudes regarding the nobility of the armed savior prior to this film coming out, based on, you know, decades of frontier mythology, especially. But
this film would also, I think, you know, I'm kind of guessing or speculating here, but I'm guessing the people who are now NRA leaders are of the age where they would have seen this film growing up, and others like it, the ones that it inspired, that also, you know, propagated that idea of the armed savior. It's, to me, it's just more of a, it's a reflection of the culture rather than, I wouldn't ascribe any kind of causal, yeah, I'm not saying this film encourages violence at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You were talking about, you see the genre, or you see cultural product generally, not within a kind of cultural vacuum. You need to kind of contextualize it and that kind of stuff. I mean, and this is just a kind of, almost a kind of throwaway comment, I guess. But, you know, why do you think that one of the startling kind of statistics that you pointed to was 30% of all films in a 3-year period were Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts as to what was specifically, you know, the appeal of the genre as opposed to kind of other genres that were doing, especially if you kind of don't ascribe to this notion of the anti-Western or whatever, but we're doing similar things. So say film noir, say things like, well, film noir is probably where I would stop that comment.
When is the year that most people cite as the end of the film noir cycle? When was Touch of Evil made? 58. So it's 41 to 58, is that the period?
But that's, yeah, but obviously it's not
roughly,
a genre,
yeah.
It's
a style.
It's not even a cycle, it's a critical. Yeah.
It's a critical imposition, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
So it's not one of the Hollywood genres where Hollywood would be like, well, you're making this film. They knew they were making
Sure. Crime
films,
right.
And they knew that there were certain types of lighting and X, Y, and Z, and certain types of narratives, and
okay.
Scenes of people looking like they're going mad in the next one, so they're like all the things, and that's a bit of a weird sort of,
right.
Yeah,
let me pull back film noir and reinsert crime into this then.
Okay, so I mentioned this as well in the paper, but I'll unpack it a bit more. So Westerns were very popular around the early 40s after,
yep,
Stagecoach. They were very popular in the beginning of filmmaking in the silent era. Largely because the frontier had essentially just closed as film making developed as an art form.
Sure.
So you had the same people who were appearing in, you know, like Buffalo Bill's kind of stage show and things like that. They were then being cast in films as well. You had real cowboys, people from that period of American culture who were still alive. And then it kind of died down a little bit until... probably because like Sam was introduced, gangster films were huge. There was just, for various reasons, there was a movement away from it. Then after 1939, Stagecoach was a very successful film. And that is kind of considered the beginning of the modern, I mean, it doesn't sound modern now, but the modern Western. And then it was very popular for a couple of years. And then during World War II, production died down because the same tropes were then transposed to jungle settings and were used in anti-Japanese,
right,
films. And then after World War II, as to recall a line I used in the paper, America was now the global hegemon. The Great Depression had ended. All of a sudden, there was a lot of optimism in the country, and American history was now being reread as a success story. So then you just had a wave of films that celebrated a very certain perspective on American history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aside from something like Birth of a Nation, there was not a lot of reference to slavery or Gone with the Wind, right? That totally,
sure,
erases slaves,
sure,
from the Civil War.
Sure.
Or essentially does, right?
Yeah.
And Native Americans were in these narratives, but they were used as foils and villains.
Mm.
So that's why there was a huge increase in those type of films being produced. So the years I cited, I believe, were 1947 to 1950. So that's,
yeah,
you know, two years after the war ended.
Yeah.
And yes, I would, as I said, it's when American history was read as a success story.
Right.
There was a line when you mentioned about the erasure of Native Americans, which is very true of Westerns, clearly. But there was this line that I found interesting in the film, which was when there were like, it was a big corporation versus a little business type of fight where they were like, oh, we were here first and stuff like that, and then they pull that line that's like, but Native Americans were here, like the Indians were here first. That's what they were, you know, and yet, you know. So I felt like there was a little bit of a,
but
at least a little bit of a, like, even though they're not present in the film at all, they kind of brought in as a way to kind of.
No, I mentioned that in the paper because they Native American. You're right, that's the scene I was referring to.
Yeah.
But Starrett, who is the good guy in the film, he doesn't say there were people here before you, they were Indians. He says there were people here before you, they were trappers and traders.
Mm-hmm.
And Riker, who's the bad guy, says he's essentially claiming ownership over the land.
Yeah.
And he bases it on the fact that he had to fight off Indians. And he says, I've got a wound from an arrow in my shoulder. And he talks about people who he was there with who died in these Indian wars.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's the one reference to Indians. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very subtle, but the good guy in the film does not take a progressive view of Native Americans.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
I wonder. I mean, I don't know. I feel as though I'm prefacing all of my comments with, oh, look, I don't know. But on the back of that comment, I've also noted that, you know, you talk earlier about the suggestion that the frontier community, you call them honest and hardworking. That's the quote you used in the paper. And I'm kind of with Debbie here that there's almost an untold story here. Whether or not the film tells it, I think perhaps you should tell it, of kind of race relations in this film.
Well, I think it's more just about, it comes down to the fact that in the early to mid-1950s, progressives had not yet reached the point where they had a revisionist view of Native Americans, right? Like, like The Searchers is the film that's considered like, oh, this is...
That's only 3 years later, though, right?
Yeah, but even that is still a horrendously racist film, in my opinion. Right?
Sure, sure.
Like, they kick the Indian woman down the hill and they use her basically as a currency.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
So even so-called progressive films in regards to that issue, like, they're still horrendously racist, right?
Sure.
So I think it's more... I would not accuse George Stevens or the author of the book as being kind of raging anti-Native Americans, right? I think it's a product of the time.
Right.
And
sure.
And again, to refer or recall something we said earlier, it's, you know, Westerns are meditations or reflections on what's going on culturally.
Yeah.
And once race issues with the civil rights movement and all that kind of stuff became kind of a hot button issue in regards to African Americans especially, then we saw the Western start to think, well, look at Indians in a different way, right? And say, well, maybe we should reflect on our mythology and maybe portray them in a slightly more positive light, right?
Do you think that's the position we're in now? I mean, I'm thinking of a show like Westworld, right? I mean, there's that. Is anyone watching Westworld in the room?
I've seen the film, 70s film.
Right, right. With you or Brenna. Yeah, right, okay. Slightly different.
I do want to see it, though. As I was saying to Debbie, I'm waiting till I get ill before I can start watching some of these series.
Yeah, back to back.
Yeah.
I guess where I was going with this, but if no one's seen it, it might be a bit useless of a conversation to bring up. But there's an interesting kind of in the second season of the current Westworld that's being produced by HBO. There's an interesting kind of episode that's framed specifically from a Native American perspective.
Mm.
And I wonder kind of, can the tropes of the Western be rejuvenated for something? I mean, you talk about the Western as kind of all cultural product is, kind of reflecting its own cultural period, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's a way of recuperating the Western for the modern period.
Well, I'm sure there is. I mean, obviously we live in a much more... politically correct society than the golden age of Westerns.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
I can't.
Sorry, that was a very politically loaded question.
Well,
it was
I
not,
just,
not
you know,
necessarily intended.
What I would find more interesting, I guess, would be Westerns that dealt more with the presence of African Americans in that period.
Yeah.
Just because there's been so much revisionism in regards to representations of Native Americans in the Western, right? Because it's just so obvious. You have to deal with it if you're making a modern Western.
Sure.
Whereas the erasure of African Americans from the frontier, I think, is a more kind of glaring omission.
Okay.
Culturally or historically.
Hmm.
I mean, the most notable Western to feature African Americans is still probably Blazing Saddles, which is a parody. Right?
Yeah, sure. Right.
And, you know, a movie that's so offensive that, that in. Offensive not so much in the way it's depicting African Americans, but its use of language that is now taboo and things like that.
Sure.
I feel like that might be a kind of forgotten film at this point, or maybe a film that's not really watched anymore or talked about. So
certainly not televised anymore.
The edited version would be about 8 minutes long, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you guys think of other films that really deal with African Americans on the frontier in a kind of sophisticated way? I mean, obviously, Samuel L. Jackson is in Hateful Eight, right? I only saw that once because I didn't like it. I can't remember that much
good.
Of it.
It's not very good.
No.
I'd go back to Westworld. I think that Westworld at least makes a kind of gesture towards this. So, you know, may a pox strike you down so you can watch the two seasons that have been released. But, your point is very valid. I can't think of any offhand, certainly.
Is Samuel Jackson's character... I've seen Hateful Eight, I can't remember. Is his character actually...
It's a bit shit.
...African-American character?
You mean, is he playing a white man?
is he identifiable as an African-American?
There was a lot that was written about.
Oh, right.
Yes, definitely.
Problems, yeah.
Okay.
I guess now I'm reminded of something like Django, which I do consider a Western, even though it's set in the South and on plantations. Like, even if it's not, like, there are horses and things like that, but it's still also, it's using the tropes of Westerns in that kind of setting.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting film and an important one. But that's kind of a notable because it's an exception.
Right.
And then Leo DiCaprio shows up in The Revenant. Again, erases all black people from the mix and does a pretty problematic job with the Native American.
Well, it basically replicates the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, but does it with Native Americans, right? Mm-hmm. That is a really wonderful film, though, in my opinion.
No.
You don't like it?
The Revenant, are we talking about?
Yeah, I liked it. Maybe stylistically, at least.
Everyone says that cinematography is real great, and sure, but I don't know.
Well, it's the best movie where a guy gets destroyed by a bear, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, but then, you know,
Of all the movies, I think, being destroyed by bears, right?
I just think if one of the things the movie has going for it is a Variety article about Leo DiCaprio being a great actor because he ate a piece of raw meat as a vegetarian, I'm checking out. That's not for me.
I guess I'm lucky because I just don't read a lot of that stuff, so I can understand why that would bother you. But that is an example, I think, of the traditional Western tropes being transposed to other settings. And I would even argue Inglourious Basterds is essentially a Western done with Nazis.
Sure. Are we expecting a rejuvenation of Westerns? I mean, are we expecting them to ever reach a 30% of Hollywood's production?
I sincerely doubt it.
Why not, I guess, would be the...
Well, I would point to economics in the sense that because of a myriad of reasons, such as downloading and streaming services and things like that, Hollywood is pumping a lot more money and effort into films that have a more global appeal, and I guess not even maybe global, but movies that are likely to play in China and South Korea and things like that, which is why we're seeing so many comic book based movies and robot based movies and action based movies where there's not as much dialogue, where the films that are action based, right.
Have you seen films like, I guess part of the reason I asked that question is the only kind of, you know, true Westerns, if you like, and I use that, you know, in scare quotes for a reason, that I've seen in the last decade or so have been coming from Australia. I mean, something like The Proposition or The Rover,
Both
like, they seem, yeah, they're both quite interesting movies. Or, I mean, potentially even the latest Mad Max. I mean, they're all kind of variants on a kind of theme that's drawing from these tropes of the Western. And I kind of wonder if we in this country are not in a similar position to America in the 50s, right? To try and...
I think there is opportunity to make a truly brilliant, epic Western in this country. Like, you know, set in our colonial times.
Definitely.
Something with Guy Pearce, for example.
Everything should have
Guy Absolutely. Pearce. Absolutely.
In the world.
Yeah.
Taking off your shirt.
I would love to be paid to write it. I've, you know, had ideas for a while, but, you know, when are you ever going to write a movie when you have a job and things like that? But no, I think there's tremendous potential for something based in Australia.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
What about something like Sweet Country? Like, that was very much interpreted by a lot of critics as...
I haven't seen it either, sorry.
Was it really?
It's really good.
I don't see it as a Western. Okay. Well, yeah, people would... when it was out of Venice last year, people were very much interpreted... I guess it does a lot of different things, but it, you know, it's an indigenous Australian film, and it changes things accordingly, but people were preparing...
What's the film before Mr. Road? It was gone blank, it was called the Alan Sand film before Mr. Road.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because that's a Western gangster.
Well, there's the recent one, Goldstone, is that it?
Goldstone's
what I'm thinking of. That's a sequel to Mystery Road.
Mystery Road, which I got them confused.
Oh, okay.
Goldstone's
one of them's noir, the other one's Western. That's how I see it.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
So it's sort of
which one's thing. Not noir?
The later one Western. Is noir because it's more like David Lynchy and sort of style. You know, sex workers in a van. Next one's it, and the earlier one is more like Western shootout at the end. Like, that's how I.
So I would still say Goldstone's a Western as well.
That's how I sort of. Sort of very broadly in terms of, because like I said,
I mean, maybe this speaks to what we're
films with indigenous Australian things. So,
I mean, maybe this speaks to what we were talking about earlier about the kind of interrelation between things like noir or crime films with the Western, right? A lot of the tropes are basically the same.
Well, they're both also this, in terms of production, I understand it because I don't know an awful lot about the Western, but part of the reason why they had so many Westerns was because they were made by the Pompey and Rose Studios. They're also known as the B pictures and the medium grey pictures.
I meant to say that, Luke, thank you.
So that means that they're all ready for work. But the ones you just
they reuse
the same
set.
Same set. So it's just the A Westerns, the ones that we maybe were studying more.
The rest are on YouTube.
There are actually less of them. It's just heaps of these other ones.
Sure.
Right, which is,
and they weren't actually very popular. Those ones weren't popular. They didn't actually get good audiences, but they were because they got a fan audience. You got people who just went to see Westerns. So they only just got maybe a little bit of profit, if not, but they were used mainly to fill it up with
lots. Yeah, and that's why you have actors like Jack Palance who are in 80 Westerns.
Yeah, because they're just repeating over.
Right,
yeah.
Which is why, to go back to Shane, why I discussed that, because it's more interesting to talk about that than it is a random B-Western that's on YouTube. But Shane, that narrative is just reproduced over and over again, so it's kind of emblematic of that type of movie and that period.
So I watched the B-Noirs, but I don't watch the
B-Noirs. B-Noirs are great.
Still time, Luke. It's still time.
It's too much content now. Like, it's hard to even have a conversation with someone because everyone's watching different stuff.
Or reading different things.
It's like when we were growing up, there's only 5 channels.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling my media students.
Yeah.
They can't fathom it.
You all watch the same stuff.
Yeah.
Everyone
would go to school talking about Hey Dad.
That's the problem. Sorry, I mean, 5 channels is probably, you're like, oh yeah, and also we're using our VHS, and you just lost the whole room. Like, I don't talk about
I'm with you, Luke. I'm with you.
Talking about with us. Well, maybe you're younger than me. I got 15 channels now.
Before we let Rodney off his hot seat, were there any closing questions before I just steal the floor again?
Is there anyone who hasn't seen Shane already willing to watch it now? Or wait?
No, look, they've got 20 channels to pick from. So.
I want to see it probably for different reasons what you're arguing, but yeah, I want to see it for other reasons. Yeah, yeah. All the stuff with the kid and the problematic content and stuff, I think it's...
Has anyone seen Hud? It's one of my all-time favourite films with Paul Newman. Has anyone seen that?
Say again, sir.
Hud, have you seen that?
Hud, no.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the same kid who's... He's grown up and he's Paul Newman's nephew in that movie, and it's like... Probably my top five movies ever. I was hoping someone had seen that and we could have a moment. But
I watched Shane and then Hud.
Good.
Shane and
Hud is better.
Okay.
But what's important?
You put it out there. You put it out there.
It's a actually it's one of those anti-westerns where it is a western, but it's set in the contemporary age. It's set in Texas in the early 60s, and the whole story is kind of about the end of a certain way of life and the beginning of a new one. Kind of like Wild Bunch, but it's set in contemporary age.
Like Justified, that show, Timothy Olyphant. You know,
I haven't seen that, mate.
Oh, well, that's maybe a contemporary Western.
Well, no country for
20 channels, you kids,
yeah.
These days.
No, it's based on the Elmore Leonard books.
Okay.
Oh, right.
And it's set in Kentucky, and it's all about him being a quick draw.
Okay.
And it's... sort of like, and maybe a little bit progressive. I'm pretty sure all the actors are all massive anti-abortion activists for some reason, but they're content is there's stuff there, but yeah, but that's maybe an example of Never Western, because he wears the hat, and it's all about him kind of each season fluctuating back and forth between this kind of like, I make my own laws, sheriff, marshal figure, to maybe I'm committing a bit of crime. To back and forth.
You've just reminded me as well, Debbie, that film that was at the film festival, is it the Joaquin Phoenix one?
You Were Never Really Here.
That's a modern, that's borrowing the Western tropes.
And I would say that film does what you were saying, it navigates that problem with the whole anti-war thing, because I think You Were Never Really Here has a character that suffers from PTSD. I think like it is anti-war without actually even at any point really glorifying or promoting. Like it steers away from that problem, right?
It doesn't show the excitement.
No, in no way it does. And if it's any kind of flashback, it's very fragmentary. But yeah,
you're right, that's a film that's purely about PTSD rather than glorifying the combat element of war, which pretty much every war film does just by its very nature. But do you agree that that's kind of a film that borrows Western tropes and puts it in a modern setting?
I haven't seen it.
Yes, okay. But the whole thing about the Western is you've got a lone figure who enters savage lands, right?
Yeah.
To either rescue someone or to bring about justice, or in Shane, right? To bring law and order to this town.
I think I see You Were Never Really Here. I can kind of see the tropes that you're pointing out, but I think that he throughout the whole film suffers a lot, and I don't think he really rescues the girl so much that she rescues him. I think for me that's I know.
But he physically rescues her.
No, he physically rescues her, but I think he's I think it plays on that.
Have you seen The Searchers?
No.
Okay. We should probably end the conversation.
Wow.
Because
you've been excommunicated, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say it's just like in The Searchers, but
I guess, you know, to kind of wrap up, I mean, one of the things I'm kind of thinking about is kind of the reproduction of Western tropes in kind of 80s action films, right? I haven't really developed the thought any further than that point, but I guess going back to something you were saying about, you know, Westerns kind of reflecting something specifically about a kind of cultural zeitgeist and implicitly about America. Why do you then think they were so successful overseas? I mean, you have a whole kind of category of spaghetti Westerns, right? You have the whole category of acid Westerns that are roughly contemporaneous with Shane. I mean, as we've kind of been talking about with the Australian kind of Westerns that are kind of currently in kind of circulation. Question mark.
I guess I I'd have to think more deeply about it, because the end of the Western as a prominent type of genre, you know, that Hollywood studios made, is pretty much coincides with Vietnam and the end of it, and after sure. Vietnam, where it's like, America, we don't really know what we're about anymore. There wasn't as much confidence in its history and its institutions and all the things it stood for. So the market wasn't there to celebrate its history. And when it did, it was what we would now call revisionist Westerns that were made by progressive people who highlighted, you know, the treatment of Native Americans and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So I'd have to think more about what's going on in those countries that were making them. I guess maybe it just comes down to the fact that even though the genre was no longer viable as, you know, something that the studios would put a lot of money into, there were still enough people who liked Westerns that there was a market for cheaply made Westerns made in Spain and Italy.
Sure.
And just simply because Sergio Leone and Clint Eastwood are amazing, those films were widely seen. Like they, I think if you ask most people what spaghetti Westerns are they familiar with, they probably couldn't name that many aside from the Sergio Leone movies.
Yeah.
Like I would say the films that were kind of knockoffs of those films have a very niche audience.
Right.
I would guess. I don't really know enough about it. Yeah.
Well, it seems as though we've reached an ending point by the lull in the room. So can we please thank Rodney for his wonderful play?
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.